Throughout his first administration, President Donald Trump did more than any other president to politicize the nation's top law enforcement agency, pressuring appointees to shield him, to target his enemies, and even to help him cling to power after his 2020 election defeat. The department, pressed into a defense of Crouch, has never fully recovered. The new book, Injustice, How Politics and Fear Vanquished America's Justice Department, exposes not only the Trump administration's efforts to undermine the department at every turn, but also how delays in investigating Trump's efforts to overturn the will of voters under Attorney General Merrick Garland help prevent the country from holding Trump accountable. The name of the book is Injustice, How Politics and Fear Vanquished America's Justice Department. Pulitzer Prize winners Carol Wenig and Aaron Davis join us on the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. What a great pleasure to have you.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Carol, at what point did you start to look at this and say that this was something that you wanted to investigate in such detail?
That's a great question. Like, what's the origin story of this book? And it really is that Aaron and I were chasing a tip. It was hard to believe in 2022, and we ultimately confirmed it and wrote a very detailed kind of magazine-style story. The tip was that the Justice Department, despite a U.S. attorney on January 7th saying, you know, the government was going to investigate the riot all the way up to the top, you know, whoever was involved, whether they were on the scene or not, they were going to investigate all the way possibly up to Donald Trump. The tip was that there was no such investigation of Trump or of his campaign for more than a year. And that was striking and surprising. And Aaron and I both knew that we had to figure out why. Why did the Justice Department, with its mantra and calling of investigating evidence of a crime without fear or favor, why did it retreat from this pretty open evidence of an attempt to interfere in a federal election, which is both a federal crime and a state crime?
And this is the Justice Department under President Joseph Biden.
That's right.
So, Aaron, when you get the tip and you look into it, where do you begin with an investigation like this? Because what was said, and then to realize that it hasn't been done, how do you ultimately confirm that?
Well, it was a long, long process, and there was a lot of obstacles to do that. But we did find essentially a series of episodes that began to tell us the story, and then we began to fill in gaps around those. And some of those stories are this: that in the right after Biden was inaugurated, and the January 6th investigation was going with all the rioters, there was an effort by prosecutors to kind of change the tone of the investigation and to shift more towards people around Trump and Trump's orbit and people like Roger Stone, who were seen with the Oath Keepers the night before the riot and then after the riot. And there was a lot of pushback. In fact, they quickly said, no, we're not going to go directly at that. We're not going to investigate people. We're going to investigate crimes. And we have so many on camera that happened at the Capitol. And that really set the course of that investigation for a long time inside the department, unknown to a lot of, almost, you know, unknown to the public. And there were other episodes. Later on, the FBI twice declined to investigate, we now know as kind of the fake elector scheme of having folks from swing states say that, in fact, Trump won all those states and use that as the impetus to pressure Pence to do something else but certify the election on January 6th. And as we began to fill in the gaps around those kind of events, we realized that there really was no one assigned to the investigation as it was described the very day after January 6th. It wasn't until April of 2022 where the FBI and the FBI director and the attorney general actually signed a document that begins that investigation 15 months after January 6th.
And it seems to me, Carol, that time is of the essence, and especially in an investigation like this one, that you've lost valuable time. If nothing else, because of the presidential term, but you've lost valuable time since the actual crime occurred.
That's right. In two ways, right? There is the evidence that is disappearing, but more importantly, the motivation of some witnesses who, if you remember, in January of 2021, a lot of Republicans were turning away from Donald Trump,
right,
furious at the violence on the Capitol, this unprecedented attack that he had essentially summoned people to by saying, you know, show up on January 6th, we'll be wild. The way he commanded them to fight like hell and go up to the Capitol the day of his speech at the Ellipsis with a group of thousands of supporters. So there was that potential loss, but there was also, as you say, the electoral clock. And Merrick Garland, the Attorney General, kind of had an allergic reaction to the idea that the Department of Justice should ever think about a political clock. But the special counsel he eventually appointed in 2022, in late 2022, had a very different view, which was, as we learned, he told his team privately, we only have so much time. We have to answer this question for voters, for the American people, and even for Donald Trump. Is there a potential crime here? Is it something we can prove beyond a reasonable doubt? Because he deserves, while he's running for re-election, to know if we decide to decline. He deserves to know that before voters go to the polls.
You write about it in the book, but Aaron, what was it about the case that really just the whole situation that he walked into that Merrick Garland was so hesitant about, and the caution that was used around this particular case?
Sure. You know, when we wrote our first, as Carol described, a kind of a magazine story about this a couple of years ago, we got some folks from the Justice Department who said, you know, you just don't understand what we're all dealing with inside here. And so much of it's because of what happened before January 6th. And so one of the things we did is we started by going back and re-reporting almost everything that happened in the Justice Department during Trump's first term. And we found that, you know, so many decisions and so many pressures had been applied on the career prosecutors and FBI agents from the top down, from the political appointees. And it really had a detrimental effect. You know, it left FBI agents very wary to go back at Trump. It left prosecutors trying to recenter and, you know, decide cases based on fact. And that's really what Merrick Garland comes in and tries to do. He says, I'm not going to be the one who decides what is just and what is not. You know, we're going to follow the Constitution. We're going to follow the law. And he tries to let cases bubble up from the ground up the way that they kind of always had for decades. And so that's his approach. Now, you know, the net effect there is, as Carol was describing a minute ago, is that, you know, if we look back at how quickly Donald Trump reemerged as a political force, it became clear, and as we were writing this book, that he knew in that first year after January 6th that he was not under investigation, that no one around him was receiving subpoenas or search warrants, and there was no active investigation into the kind of things that he then recast as January 6th being nothing but a, you know, a tourist trip to the Capitol.
Carol, when you look at, which Aaron was just referring to, in regards to the back and forth and the disputes between the DOJ and the FBI, how common is that on any given investigation versus the disputes that were happening with this investigation?
You know, tension between prosecutors and FBI agents, even tensions between higher-ups at DOJ and lower-level career officials, it's not that unusual.
Right.
What was so shocking was the nature of the disputes in this case. I'll give you an example. We wrote extensively for the paper and then learned even more for the book about a bitter fight that was happening between the DOJ officials who were leading the classified documents probe and the FBI agents that prosecutors were telling, we are going to search Donald Trump's property at Mar-a-Lago. I know I'm zooming ahead a little bit, but this kind of captures the kind of tension. That dispute was that the FBI said, hey, we're not the records police. We're not going down and searching in a surprise raid the former president's home looking for presidential records. And the DOJ officials said, look, we have surveillance tape now showing, and we have a witness now telling us and has a picture of multiple boxes stored at Mar-a-Lago, an inside source showing that there are a lot more records here, and we have to presume that important, closely guarded national security secrets are in those boxes based on what we've already experienced with the former president. We have probable cause to believe a crime is being committed, and we have to go. And the DOJ National Security Division Assistant Attorney General asks a top FBI official as they leave this meeting where the FBI field office says, we're not doing it. You'll have to order me to do it. The Assistant Attorney General, Matt Olson, says to this Assistant Director, Alan Kohler, what's going on? Why? The FBI is always the one that wants to do a raid. Why do they not want to do this? And the Executive Assistant Director at the FBI, Alan Kohler, responds, these guys are walking over the bodies. You got to understand, they're walking over the bodies in their office of Crossfire Hurricane, which was a reference to the fact that the FBI had already faced numerous internal investigations launched essentially by Trump's allies over the Russian probe called Crossfire Hurricane that was about, did Russia try to help Trump get elected? Did Russian operatives have inappropriate contacts with Trump's campaign? And agents had been singed, and careers, if not ruined, careers sidelined by criticism and attacks from Trump and his Republican friends. And they were wary of sort of tangoing with Trump again.
Carol Wenig and Aaron Davis join us this morning. The name of the new book, Injustice: How Politics and Fear Vanquished America's Justice Department. Aaron, it struck me several times while I was reading the book, and I'm wondering how true you think this is, but was there just a general sense, and not that it led to the actions or the inaction, but that there was a general sense that Trump was out of office. There was little chance he was going to get back into office, especially given what happened on January 6th, that would forever taint him, and that would allow them to hopefully perhaps make it look like they were seeking justice, and yet also allow the new administration, the Biden administration, to move on and do the work of the people.
Boy, I really think you hit on an important point right there, which is that we've, from our reporting that when the Attorney General comes in, Merrick Garland, he really thinks that, and just for a little snippet from the book, on January 6th, he is sitting in his home writing what's going to be his acceptance speech for the nomination to be Attorney General. And his wife comes in and says, turn on the television, and there's the riot at the Capitol. And he begins to rewrite parts of what he's about to go say the next day when he stands on stage with Joseph Biden. And, he really felt and told people at the time that, this fever, if you will, the such really pro-Trump feeling had was bound to burst, that, people weren't going to accept that image of what happened that day. And so there really, he did not really feel that there was an urgency to this. They were going to have time, that they would work their way up, and there was a structure and there was a plan to their investigation, which was that they kind of approached it the way you would a mob case, and they tried to go, the rioters being the lowest guys on the pole, and to try to get to them and get on camera what they did and interview them and see what they where they got orders from, and this worked to a degree. They got up to the highest levels of some of the militia groups, the anti-government groups, the Oath Keepers, the Proud Boys, but there was never a real tight connection that they found between those groups and the folks like Mark Meadows and Rudy Giuliani and people who are around Trump, who are doing this whole other basket of things, which was trying to pressure states to send in other electors, or to get Mike Pence to not certify the election. And so there is a unfortunate realization about a year and a half into this whole process when folks around Merrick Garland realized that these fake elector documents were really something that could have been investigated differently. In fact, when they do open that investigation in April 2022, those documents that have been sitting out there at that point in time publicly for over a year are cited as the predicate by the FBI to open that investigation. And someone kind of in the circle around Merrick Garland says, we realized kind of then that these were the weapons left at the crime scene.
When it comes to Jack Smith, Carol, was he most hamstrung by the fact of starting so late? And then he still has to deal with sort of the debris within the department that's going on as well.
Yeah. Well, he certainly was handed a lousy hand. You know, Aaron and I come to discover he's kind of a bionic man kind of figure. He takes this job November 18th, 2022. At that point, the election interference case into Donald Trump and his campaign is extremely fledgling. It started 15 months late. It was frozen by Attorney General Merrick Garland for 2 months before the election. So 17 months out of the first 20, there's been no investigation. Then with the classified documents case, that one is far more advanced, and but there's more evidence to gather. And when he gets the job, he's just had a horrible bicycle accident, compound fractures in his leg. He's been screaming so loud when in the hospital when his pain meds expire, essentially, that they have to move him to a different ward because he's waking other patients up. He's living in the Netherlands as a chief prosecutor of war crimes in The Hague, but he takes himself off the painkillers against medical advice, takes himself out of the hospital so that he can completely sanely, without any question about his mental status, take the oath of office as special counsel. But he's got two cases that he wants to move quickly on, and it's really very challenging. In the classified documents case, he tells the prosecutors who come to brief him in the Netherlands just around Thanksgiving, he tells them, can we make a decision on whether or not to indict Donald Trump in 3 months? And they're flabbergasted. They've never seen that kind of speed before. And they say, wait a minute, you know, maybe 6 months we can make a decision. We've got to work with the CIA and the intelligence community on these classified documents that we recovered. And on the election interference case, it's complicated. It's not an easy case. I mean, all prosecutors joke that, like, the go-to charge when you can't figure out how to bring a case is conspiracy, but that's what they're structuring is a conspiracy case, and it's complicated because no other president has tried to overturn an election before, and that is a challenge. He also, Jack Smith, faces another major challenge, which is when his classified documents case, speeding forward to 2024, is about to go down the tubes because Eileen Cannon, the judge in Florida, has dismissed it on the argument that he wasn't properly appointed as a special counsel, a seriously questionable legal decision on her part. When he asked the Department of Justice for approval to move to recuse that judge, the DOJ turns him down. That is the end of that case.
As I was reading the book, at the time, the story was breaking that the current DOJ is going after and getting ready to investigate Obama administration officials. To think of what happened on January 6th, that is almost completely brushed under the rug. Anyone who was penalized for that is let go. And now this Justice Department has thrown out every rule book, every idea that was in place, and correct me if I'm wrong, but almost solely in the job of retribution.
You know, there's just a sea change inside the Department of Justice in the last 10 months since President Trump came in. And we kind of take you inside those rooms where this becomes real for everyone. You know, when Pam Bondi welcomes Donald Trump into the Department of Justice for a press conference. Unusual to begin with to have a press conference inside the Department of Justice building for the president. Usually they try to keep an arm's length between, you know, those two places. But for this particular one, they go to the length of putting up this kind of stage inside the Department of Justice. They bring in these blue curtains and cover up some of the statues of the Spirit of Justice. And Pam Bondi goes on stage and says, "We're so lucky to be here and work at the directive of Donald Trump." And some jaws drop around the Justice Department, not just in that building, but other places where listening to this, because it's just so fundamentally different than how any previous attorney general had spoken about where they take their direction from. You know, the comparison is when Garland comes in that day, years earlier, and President Biden says, "I'm not your boss. You don't take orders from me. Your job is to the American people and to the Constitution." And that was a shade of pretty much how every previous president had talked about the role of the attorney general, as to the law, and an independent operator in so many ways. And now we are in a place where President Trump has exercised his ultimate authority over the Department of Justice and has pushed his political appointees to take action. And they are responding very quickly, you know, from his former FBI director to the New York Attorney General to, you know, threats of sitting congressmen being under investigation to everyone involved with the Russia investigation, which, you know, to go back and try to remember where things were at that point in time, there was a whole lot of reasons that there was a, you know, and there have already been many investigations into why intelligence officials in the United States were concerned about, you know, what seemed like clandestine discussions between Russians and an incoming presidential administration. So we are definitely wholly in a different place. And that's kind of where we try to bring it to at the end of the book, which is, you know, just how different. And that's why it takes on the length of so many years, is because we try to show people how far we have gotten from the norms of the way justice was really handled for two centuries in this country.
And you can only wonder what it's going to be after a full administration. If a full, we're only less than a year in, with three more years on top of it.
Yeah, there's a lot of rage and fear inside the Department of Justice and the FBI at what's happened at such a rapid clip. Aaron and I had to put the pen down essentially on this book in April of this year, and it was a sprint to get it published in November. But some really stunning things happened before April, and even more stunning things happened after. As our editor said, there's like this trajectory, right? We know the trajectory that Donald Trump is on now that he has seized the reins of the Department of Justice, and it is to use it for retribution first and foremost. Centuries worth of expertise at the Department of Justice and the FBI have been, you know, broomed out the door. We report how executive assistant directors, all the senior leadership of the seventh floor of the FBI, were essentially forced out, and they all are watching Kaj Patel in a confirmation hearing on the TV screens behind them as he's testifying to get the job of FBI director, say he doesn't know anything about any firings that are going on. And they believe that he's lying to Congress as they're watching him, because they're being told, "You need to resign or be fired because Kaj Patel and Stephen Miller want the, you know, senior folks here who were associated with FBI Director Chris Wray and the previous presidential administration out." But the things that happened after we put the pen down, like Jim Comey was indicted by a prosecutor who had been a prosecutor for 2 days and was installed expressly at Donald Trump's instruction, because not one person in the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Eastern District of Virginia that was investigating Comey believed there was evidence to convict him or even to, you know, unlaughably bring charges before a grand jury. The trajectory is not great, and that rage and fear I mentioned at the beginning is girding a certain amount of resistance inside. Some sources that are sort of holding on by their fingernails hopeful that they can hold on and help rebuild this venerable institution once this presidency is over.
The name of the new book is Injustice: How Politics and Fear Vanquished America's Justice Department. Carol Wenig and Aaron Davis are Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporters for the Washington Post, and I'm sure the both of you have already picked up your pens and are at it again on this very beat. It's a great pleasure to have you both on the program. Congratulations on the book, and thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so
Pleasure.
much for shining a light on this. Sorry, Aaron, go ahead.
No, yeah, pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Be well. Thank you. Again, the name of the book, Injustice. It is published by Penguin Press. You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC.